Soon after Orpheus met the maiden he loved, Eurydice, they were married, but their joy was brief. Directly after the wedding, as the bride walked in a meadow with her bridesmaids, a viper stung her and she died. Orpheus's grief was overwhelming. He could not endure it. He determined to go down to the world of death and try to bring Eurydice back. He said to himself, "With my song, I will charm the lords of death, moving their hearts with my melody. I will bear her away from Hades." For his love, he dared more than any other man ever dared. He took the fearsome journey to the underworld, and there he struck his lyre, and at that sound, all that vast multitude were charmed to stillness. And Orpheus said, "O gods, who rule the dark and silent world, a little while we tarry upon earth, and then we are yours forever and forever. But I seek one who came to you too soon. I tried to bear my loss. I could not bear it. See, I ask a little thing, only that you will lend, not give, her to me. She shall be yours when her year's span is full." No one, under the spell of his voice, could refuse him anything. They summoned Eurydice and gave her to him, but upon one condition, that he would not look back at her as she followed him until they had reached the upper world. And so the two passed through the great doors of Hades to the path which would take them out of the darkness, climbing up and up. He knew that she must be just behind him, but he longed unutterably to give one glance to make sure. But now they were almost there. The blackness was turning gray, and now he had stepped out joyfully into the daylight, and then he turned to her. It was too soon. She was still in the cavern. He saw her in the dim light, and he held out his arms to clasp her, but on the instant she was gone. She had slipped back into the darkness. All he heard was one faint word, "Farewell." Desperately, he tried to rush after her and followed her down, but he was not allowed. The gods would not consent to his entering the world of the dead a second time, not a second time while he was still alive. He was forced to return to the earth alone in utter desolation. He wandered through the wild solitudes of Thrace, comfortless except for his lyre, playing, always playing. And the rocks and the rivers and the trees heard him gladly, his only companions.
When we lose someone or something we deeply love, we don't know it right away. We think, they must be nearby. Let me go after them. We trek down to the underworld to recover them, and for a time we reside there, the living who have turned away from life, filled up instead with dead things and lost memories and irretrievable endings. We may not even realize we've traveled to such a place, believing that this too is life, that it will take some sprucing up and positive thinking, but blow some air into its lungs, resurrect what was, reclaim, and it will be revived. For a time, it is all we can do, all we must do. It is so human, this holding on. It is a sign we have loved, a sign we risked our hearts breaking just like this, a sign that it took, that it was real, that we are real. Holding on like this reminds me of my favorite story from the Torah, fitting for a Sunday where the Jewish holy days have just concluded. Jacob had been away from home for a long, long time when he decided to return. His big family, that is, his wives, plural wives, and 11 children, big family, had never seen his homeland. And he had recently been having a hard time with his father-in-law, so it was time. They'd traveled many miles, day and night, to return, when one evening they were to cross the river Jabbok. Jacob took each of his family members and all of his belongings, and he sent them all ahead. He told them he'd follow them the next morning. Once he was alone, a man came up to him and started wrestling with him. A man, or maybe it was God, or maybe an angel. We don't know. The text says all of these. It isn't clear. They wrestled and wrestled, and the man, God, angel, was sure that Jacob would give up, but he just wouldn't. And so he got a little aggressive and hit him on his hip, and Jacob's hip was put out of its socket. He ended up permanently disabled, but still he kept wrestling. The man, God, angel, said to Jacob, "Really, let go. The day is breaking." And still Jacob kept wrestling. He said to him, "I won't let go unless you bless me." The man, God, angel, asked him, somewhat exasperatingly, I can imagine, "What is your name?" And he answered, "Jacob." And in response, the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with humans, and you have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him to tell him his name, but he asked, "Why do you ask?" And then he blessed him and disappeared. Even once we realize what we have lost, still there is the holding on, the determined, stubborn wrestling. There is almost always an injury, often permanent. There is the sending away of those we love, as we tread into the underworld, and there is the turning back for one more glance. And sometimes, as much as we wish to prevent it, there is the going down with the ship. Sometimes, after the loss, a lot of the time we pray, there is a blessing and a new name, a new life, a new beginning, the crossing the river and beginning again. How you will react, how I will, how we will be able to care for each other after the loss, we cannot predict. We may try to prepare and imagine, embrace ourselves. We might say things like, "Well, at least I'm not in so-and-so's situation. That would be impossible." Hoping such comparisons will make us feel more capable. Unfortunately, grief doesn't work like this. A broken heart is a broken heart. Suffering, suffering. A better prediction than some ranking of things lost is the weighted accumulation of loss by any one person or community, and the tools and practices built up in those who have lost before they are asked to face life irreparably changed, however so. We build resiliency not by avoiding pain, but through the witness of our repeated survival. We build resiliency through the witness of our repeated survival. To have come this far in life, however far that might be, we all must have our coping mechanisms, those things which hold us together when life falls apart. When I've been stuck in my own struggles of loss, one of my dearest friends likes to ask me about my survival techniques, and then she swears to help keep them intact. She says, "I'll never take away your tools right when you need them most." It's a kind of semi-promise, a promise that only careful friends and thoughtful ministers, and not just the ordained kind, make to one another. Because if any of us love each other, really love each other the way that David spoke about last Sunday, or in the ways we mean to describe when we speak about courageous love, when we speak about standing on the side of love, we know our call is to both love one another for exactly who we are, exactly as we are, to keep each other safe and surviving, and also call each other to something more, for a life beyond mere survival. This bright faith kind of love knows that though we will not be taking away each other's life preservers, we must simultaneously help each other build and know how to deploy our rescue helicopters. Now, liberal religion has not historically done enough in this realm. We tend to live more comfortably in the intellectual realm, the careful and studied distance of analysis, rather than the messy, unpredictable, and vulnerable realm of grief and loss. Tragedy unravels our illusion of control, which our privileges mostly allow us to keep up, and we'd rather not. And even with a greater courage, I also wonder if we lack confidence that our faith has enough to say in response to loss. Last month, many of us said that we place our faith in humanity, in the natural world, in community. And yet, what if these are the very things that fail? When we lose the people that we have counted on, or when we put in our best effort and love seems to make no difference, or when natural disaster strikes, when community fails to show up, what does our faith have to say then? Many of our churches have, over time, realized that we could go years at a time without dealing meaningfully with life's brokenness, loss, death, or grief, which means not dealing meaningfully with life at all, since life is filled with loss. The fuller and richer the life, the greater the depth of loss. Theme-based ministry, a practice that many of our congregations, including ours, have taken up in recent past, allows us to more intentionally address all the seasons of the human experience, not just beginnings, but also endings, not just love, but also loss. And in doing so over the course of the month, across multiple kinds of programs, we can engage the fullness of these worthy questions with depth and care. This morning, we begin our new month, and so our new theme, grief. Our whole congregation, all ages, the children and youth over in their classrooms now and us here, we begin a month-long meditation on the practices, tools, questions, and blessings that arise when attempting to come to terms with loss. Each of you are invited to join on this journey, to travel with us into the underworld, where those people and things and places we've loved reside, and to stay in the struggle for a time. And in this invitation, we make also my friend's promise to each other that we need not take away the tools that allow any of us to survive. We trust that each person can go at a pace and depth that feels right for them. And still, in our careful walk with one another, our careful listening and tender presence, we hope to call each of us to something more than our existing tools, to learn together new practices of transformation and healing and health in life's inevitable encounter with loss. Because grief, you may have noticed, it has an agenda. It has an agenda, and it comes for us like a man in the night, a man or an angel or maybe God. We don't know. It won't tell us for sure. But it has a plan, and we just get to respond. We can pull away and study the man from a distance, describe his attributes as if they have nothing to do with us or our lives. We can pretend he's not there, turn away, hope he leaves. Or we can try to scooch around him, keep on our original path, leave him behind, though likely knowing he'll remain there indefinitely, awaiting our response. Or we can look grief in the eye and wrestle. We can be present to grief, the losses we've experienced across our lifetimes, losses from death or transition or change, losses of places, of identity, or status. We can be present to the loss in our own community. The loss of our now retired beloved senior minister, who I know I have been feeling grief for. Maybe you have too. I miss Mark. We can say that. We can feel that together. We can feel all these things together. Let ourselves acknowledge the struggle and the pain and maybe the anger or the negotiation tactics, like just one more look. And we can keep wrestling, refusing to resolve anything before it's time. In the recent issue of the Unitarian Universalist Journal, Quest, Meg Riley tells the story of grieving after the death of her mother. After her mom had died, she developed TMJ, which it means a really long word, but basically it means that her jaw hurt really bad, and she couldn't get it to feel better, no matter what she and her dentist tried. Finally, she realized that the one thing that stopped the pain was crying. So after that, she didn't get out of bed in the morning until she had literally driven herself to tears. And many days, she says she didn't want to cry. It was only the threat of severe pain that made her linger on sad memories. It convinced her that crying was a priority. She acknowledges in retrospect that her body was brilliant in demanding that she take time to grieve, rather than let herself get away with the things that her rational mind wanted to say, like, yes, it's sad, but it was a long time coming. Or, she had 3 good years. Or, she wouldn't want me to cry. Instead, her body just said, cry, or else it will really hurt. In many cultures across time, acts of grieving like this has been considered a holy, even sacramental practice. The Reverend Forrest Church reminds us of the ancient Roman tear cup practice, wherein after a loss, you pick up your tear cup and you put it under your eye and weep into it. When you're finished weeping, you cap it and put it away. It's a way to save your tears. Save them because they're precious, for they show you care. A cup full of tears is proof you have felt deeply, suffered, and survived. Can you imagine such a practice being a part of our everyday world today? If I squint, I can imagine men carrying around their tear cups with pride, teaching their children to position them under their eyes just so, to learn what is worthy of holy tears and what is not. I can see grandmothers passing on their cups to their granddaughters, telling them as they did of the losses that they have borne, which is to say the loves of their lives, the expanse of their hearts. We inherit those losses anyways. Pain is passed on like any other family inheritance. Even in my children with us since they were just a few days old, I can feel the generations of suffering that they carry from their biological family history. Still, even when we grow up with our birth families, most of the time, such loss remains only felt, not spoken. And so our lives are shaped by grief that we don't fully understand. Grief often left incomplete and unresolved by the generations before us. What a gift it would be to have these stories shared early and often. What a gift that we might learn to hear one another, companion one another in our grief, just as we learn to laugh together or play. What a gift to help our parents or grandparents, uncles or aunts, friends or even strangers wrestle with these stories until the blessing is finally clear. Instead, we tend to send our family members off into the night while we stay at the shore to do the work all on our own. Either that or our friends and family themselves decide they don't know what to do to help, so they do or say nothing and send themselves off across the river, hoping we'll catch up. It doesn't need to be this way. While it is true that no one can do the grieving for you, right? No one can wrestle in your place, we need not meet grief alone. Standing at the river, readying ourselves for the long night, the presence of others can make all the difference between grief that yields a blessing and grief that keeps us wandering the underworld. Dr. Alan Wolfelt, a well-known author and grief counselor here in Fort Collins, describes what it would take to be such a life-saving presence for others in their grief. He talks about being a companion, which means our practice is simply to be present to another's pain rather than trying to take that pain away. We go out into the wilderness with another. We go out, but we're not responsible for finding the way back. We don't have to know how that wrestling will end. We just have to hold the faith that it will. In our presence, we are guided by the spirit and the heart. Try to let go of our need to analyze or lead with our heads. Instead, we just bear witness in compassionate curiosity, walk alongside, and simply refuse to judge or direct or fix. At the riverbanks of another's grief, there is silence, stillness, and it's okay. Our presence need not fill up every moment with words or movement. It can be uncomfortable, but that's okay too. Walking with another in their grief is a holy practice, as it brings love to bear in the midst of darkness and a light of hope and faith to keep going until that day breaks. Though all you're required to do is nothing, such a presence is anything but easy. It's hard and heartbreaking to see another in pain, especially one you know and love, and not want to try to take that pain away. It's hard not to believe that you know the way out. You can see it. Just go that way. It's hard to remain clear on the angels that are yours to wrestle and those that are not. And so in our efforts, we'll stumble and struggle ourselves. We'll mess up and try to control and fix or analyze and compartmentalize. And the ones grieving, We will act out and try to let go too soon or hang on too long. But rather than give up, let's forgive ourselves and each other and begin again in love. This is our covenant, which is our practice for this month, for this year, for our whole lives. Walking together, we learn how to hold on and how to let go. And we gain the clarity and strength to do so. We learn how to leave the land of the dead and return to the living with a new name. For after the wrestling, let us cross the river and go in search of life. May it be so. Amen.